elements of Azure's infrastructure, and let's talk in more detail about what you get from those elements. So when you talk about infrastructure, right? So here's all the different broad pieces that you have for a cloud infrastructure. So you've got a data center, which is the physical facility. You get the power, you get the cooling, etc. You've got servers that are running in the data center. You've got a network that brings traffic into the data center and the traffic within the data center. There's some content cut out from the bottom of the slide, which is actually the most important piece, which is the software that runs, right? So you have, now what's the difference between Azure and some data center hoster that you have seen here is basically the heart of the matter is in the software. So think about deploying, think about monitoring, think about recovering from incidents, etc. So you have to have software that automates all those things. So that's a key piece of the infrastructure that we provide. And then I've added this thing called trust. So where we have things like security, privacy, compliance. So when I talk to customers, really nobody asks me about the first few things. Everybody asks me about the trust aspects. Right? So I have to take my data from my data center to public cloud. What does that mean? What will you do with my data? Will others be able to see my data? What are the processes you follow, etc. So those are very important pieces I consider of the infrastructure as well. So this whole thing put together is what we call as an Azure region. So it's not just a data center running some servers. So that's why we make it a point to use the term region instead of using the term data center. So although we use the term data center to lure you into this presentation, really what I always talk about is Azure regions. So really in this discussion, what I want to do is I want to deep dive into each of these elements. And we can go as deep as you want, or please feel free to stop me and ask me questions. So my goal is more to have people take away something rather than just overload you with a bunch of information. So please feel free to stop me anytime. If I can get a bit of an understanding of people's profiles so that I can tailor to that. So how many people who have a lot of experience with data centers? How many people who develop services that run in data centers? And anybody else, any other profile that you want? Alright, so those are kind of the broad profiles that we're getting for. Okay, let's start with actually the data center piece itself. So this is the building and the power and the cooling, etc. So let's talk about how Microsoft's data centers have evolved and what you'll get from Microsoft data centers at this point. So when we started our own internal, when we went beyond having servers running in Microsoft campus, that happened in the beginning in 1989, and that was the rudimentary data center where you have a rack available, people bring their servers in, they plug it in, right? So we've seen that stuff. That was the first generation. And then as people realize the value of consolidating their servers in a data center, then you start getting into the second generation, which is the density. So basically you get a pre-populated rack and you run a bunch of capacity in that rack. And I should probably elaborate a little bit on what PUE means. How many people know that metric? So it's basically something along the lines of power usage efficiency. So what it means is you're pumping a bunch of power into this building. What part of that is being used to actually run the service? Right? So a PUE of 2 in generation 1 means that for every 2 units of power I pump into the data center, only 1 is being actually used to run the service. The rest is getting wasted in powering and lights and cooling and lights and all other ancillary things. And so if you go now to from generation 2 to generation 3, what really happened is sometime in the early 2000s is when somebody wrote a paper and said PUE is a metric. So then all the vendors selling equipment for data centers realized that they'll go out of business if they don't use a metric. So over a period of time, 5-8 years later, you started seeing some good cooling technology come out. So that's where, I know that a lot of people now are familiar with things like hot air containment, cold air containment. So how do you make sure that you minimize the amount of energy that's spent on cooling the data center, etc.? So those improvements came into generation 3. So really the containment is all about how do we contain the volume of air that needs to be cooled in the data center. Right? And then the cooling equipment, etc. starts getting better. They use better technologies that spend less power, etc. So that's the third generation. the fourth generation now people start thinking about, okay, now I'm thinking about a building separately, I'm thinking about a power plant separately, I'm thinking about cooling separately. What if we put all these together ground up and design a data center of the future, model a data center? So what that gives you, so in Gen 3 we talked about, you know, you start getting efficiency. In Gen 4 you start getting scalability. So now I'm able to stamp out data centers quickly because I know every piece end to end. And so I can match supply demand. So that's where Microsoft really, at this point if you look at the timeline, you know, this is when the online services start taking off, etc. So now we have the ability to stamp out data centers. Now what is the next frontier for us is software defined data centers. So now if you look at the PUE ranges, in the earlier generations you see them steadily falling. Now you've reached a point of efficiency where you can't squeeze out much more, right? So now the next bit is going to be on flexibility. So think about, you know, every time you have a hardware device, you're restricted in how much you can innovate. So now if you take all that functionality into software, you can innovate faster, you can build more flexibility, and we'll talk about some aspects of that with software defined networking. So that's the future. So if you look at our next generation data centers that will come up in the US, they'll all be kind of generation 5 data centers. And to make it more specific for you guys in terms of, you know, what are we getting in India, you're going to see a mix of Gen 3, Gen 4, Gen 5 data centers, right? So like all the things that we innovate for the US data centers in terms of software defined features will all automatically come to India. And some of the physical aspects may probably be the earlier generation. So that's what you can expect. Any questions so far? So now let's talk about the next piece, which is the server. So let's think about, you know, what are the requirements that Microsoft faces for our server platform. Okay, so we have about 100 plus data centers running across 40 different countries. And we have a million servers running across those data centers. So that's the scale at which we operate. So we have to be able to have a server platform that will be able to run our various workloads. So the most common workloads that people can recognize will include things like Azure, Office 365, Bing, etc. So you can think each of these would have significantly different characteristics. If we want to optimize and if we want to have a, you know, consolidated supply chain for our servers, then we need a server platform which is capable of running various types of workloads. So what would that look like? It would have minimum number of components as simple as possible so that we can then put it at scale. It would have standardization, it would have the ability to plug in some extra cards or, you know, some do some customization based on workload. And then if you now think about our requirements to run across all these countries, you think about the thermal profiles in those data centers, you think about the power supply kind of profiles in those geographies. So we have to be able to take that variety as well. And the server platform has to be able to take the evolution. So we have to be able to deploy kind of evolving SKUs into the same platform. So as every year we get new chipsets, we get better processors, we have to be able to take advantage. So those are kind of some of the requirements that we have to keep in mind when designing our server platform. So our server platform is called Open Cloud Server. We are on V2 of that platform right now. We've actually contributed the specs for the server platform to an open source project called Open Compute Project. So this is a project created by some of the top kind of data center or online service providers like Facebook, Google, Microsoft, etc. And to collaborate and improve the state of the data center industry. So in fact, there was a summit just last week in the US where Microsoft shared some advances in terms of our power management, etc. So this is a good contribution we've made. In terms of benefits, we've already seen the cost of acquisition of hardware has gone down by 40% for us through this platform. And power costs have gone down by 15%. So you'll be getting in the India data centers pretty much the state of the art in terms of our server platform and so on. So now if you start thinking about when you get the standard infrastructure, so the server platform, the servers, the racks, the blades, the network devices, the cabling, everything is standard. So you can think about this assembly line that's churning out racks. So we have the ability now like to grow as fast as our customers are used to. And we can produce these racks globally using our global supply chain and roll them out to meet the demand. So what you would expect in India is, you know, more just as much as demand as we see, we'll be able to provide supply. And so as a customer, you'll be able to expect any amount of capacity. So let's progress to talking about network. So Microsoft is one of the largest owned and operated networks in the world. So by some count it's second, by some count it's third. We have, as I mentioned, more than 100 data centers. We peer with more than 3,000 internet service providers across the world who account for more than 98% of the world's internet traffic. So we have multiple terabits per second of ingress and egress happening with the internet on a consistent basis because the world never sleeps. And between our data centers, we have dedicated network, of course, and much of it is Microsoft-owned dark fiber. So we have thousands of miles of Microsoft-owned dark fiber connecting our data centers with each other. Other important points, we do have, of course, customers expect edge and caching and acceleration solutions, so we do have edge locations across the world besides all our network present points of presence. We also have, you know, due to the scale at which we operate, we invest a lot into automation and tooling to manage the network, so that benefit automatically our customers get when they use our data centers. A significant example of such a tool would be the infrastructure we use for detecting and mitigating DDoS attacks.
So that particularly comes by default if you have using
Azure? So, in Azure, yes. So it would depend on the workload. So for Azure, yeah, you're absolutely right. So you get protected from that. So now let's take a peek into what does the network architecture look like within our data center. So the earlier slide was about the macro view of Microsoft Network. Once the traffic enters the data center, what does it look like? So I joined Azure in 2010. So when I started, our architecture looked like the diagram on the left. So really what that is it's your classic hierarchical tree structure where the traffic enters your data center router at the top, layer 3 traffic is coming in, and then it ends up in this big, huge layer 2 domain right, at the bottom of the tree. And so you end up with a number of issues with this, primary being you run into performance bottlenecks in the L2 domain. You run into issues with the hardware devices which you can see in green, the load balancers, the firewalls, etc. So single points of failure. You have limited capability to innovate because those are hardware devices with a life cycle, and once you buy it, that's what you have. You have to wait for the next hardware device. You run into incident response. There are manual steps involved if hardware is involved, so that slows down. So as you start running, you know, mission critical workloads, those manual incident response starts to bite. Right? So those are the kind of issues that we found with that design. So we've since transitioned for multiple years now, we've been running a new design, which is more of a mesh-based structure. So the whole thing runs on layer 3 traffic. Any two nodes, any two kind of servers that are sitting, which need to communicate to each other, have multiple paths to communicate. And so losing one network link doesn't impact the network. Also, we've moved all these devices that are the solid green boxes, the hardware devices have all moved into distributed software applications. So, you really have software-defined networking.
But compared to there are no security hacks,
we have, we can get into that if you hold your question for a bit. We'll go a little bit more into the security features we provide as well as network logical isolation. So, now what we've done is we've removed all the bottlenecks for PERF, we've improved the reliability and availability. And now we have added the ability to innovate. Because if you take a look at any kind of hardware device, right? So both your data plane, which is the flow of data, and your control plane, which is the configurations, etc., are locked into the same device. Now I can have different teams working on data plane and control plane. One of the teams can be deploying every week if they want. All those capabilities can start. So you can innovate at a far more rapid pace. So that's the network design. So any questions or comments?
Software.
So I'm not sure how much of that I can disclose. We are cutting edge, we'll compete with any cloud, public cloud. So we talked about the hardware pieces, right? We talked about data center, server, network. And I said the software is what's going to set a public cloud platform apart. and get us to hyperscale. So let's talk a little bit about what are the software capabilities you need to get to a hyperscale cloud platform. Right? So let's start with data. So what you would expect when you put your data on a public cloud platform from an availability standpoint is you would expect your data to be available all the time. So how do we implement that is two things. One is synchronous replication within a region and asynchronous cross-region replication. So let me just step back again for a second and explain what these terms mean. Right? So we are entering India. So India is a geography. So we've got multiple geographies that we've entered, like US, Asia Pacific. In a geography, we will enter multiple regions. And the reason for entering a geography is because customers will get data residency within that geography. So if you're in a regulated environment and there are restrictions that say your data cannot go out of the country, then we have to enter that geography. Once we enter that, we have to give you the ability to replicate your data and maintain redundancy so that if you have a bad issue in one region, you're still covered. That's the reason why you need multiple regions. So now coming back, when you write some data, the storage, right? What will happen is three copies of the data will be created and persisted to disk before the call is even returned to you. So that's how we provide durability. Right? So irrespective of small failures that happen within the storage time that's hosting your data is always durable. And then asynchronously what happens is as a customer you can choose to enable geo-replication. So whenever we set up a storage stamp for you, we will also set up a secondary storage stamp in the other region, in the paired region, which will take your geo-replication. So you get that for free if you enable geo-replication, right? So then what happens is the system takes care. As soon as your three copies were created in the primary and the call was returned, there's an asynchronous call that's generated, which will similarly create three copies in the secondary. Cross-region traffic. Yeah. So a synchronous replication happens within the same region, and then the geo-replication happens to the paid region. So when you're running multiple VMs, so you want to make sure that you're running enough VMs so that some normal course of events doesn't impact your availability. So we partition our capacity into what we call as fault domains. So you can think of very simple, like if you're running two role instances of the same kind of VM, you don't want to be running them on the same machine, right? Because if it goes down, you lose both. That's a very simple example for a fault domain. So our fault domains are of course more sophisticated than that. So it's at a rack level, so that you know if you think about, you have a power device which can fail or so. So we design our fault domains. And if you deploy an application which uses multiple instances of a VM, we will automatically deploy them across multiple fault domains. So if you get a fault, your availability is not impacted. Similarly, the point number four talks about availability sets or upgrade domains. So when we are rolling out a software upgrade in the platform, it might take your VMs down. And so we might have to roll it out in such a way, in a phased manner, across different availability, across different upgrade domains, so that you will at any given time have availability of some of your VMs. So that's right. So
you can choose the downtime, right? Or it's done by default. You just go ahead and
so right now at this point you don't have the ability to choose.
Is there any impact on the upgrade?
So it depends on the service. Yes, so like for example if we're rolling out an upgrade to the OS. So if you're, yeah, so across your entire set, there's no availability impact because you'll have a minimum set that operates.
How about the service? Customer, what service they are getting to one portion of the availability set. Second drive, let's say there is an upgrade happening, there shouldn't be any impact.
That's correct. So that's the idea of an availability set.
Yeah.
So once you set up your availability set, you'll get availability. But if you're not setting up your availability set, then you might be impacted when you roll out.
As you're saying, the availability set, also you are trying to upgrade the other node,
correct.
Other storage, other network. This thing won't be impacted. That is what
yeah, correct. So then we'll talk about service healing. So service healing is kind of follows on from when a fault occurs in the system. So let's say that you've built your network to run a certain number of role instances of a given role. Right? So let's say you've built a application ground up, a cloud service, let's say, which has three instances of your front end role. Let's say that the hardware hosting one of your instances went down. So now you've temporarily gone down two instances. We have the ability to detect that and automatically spin up the third instance again on a healthy node or a healthy server. So that's what we refer to as service healing. So this is a key. If I go back to kind of what are the key software patterns that you need in place from a hyperscale platform, you need automated deployment, you need automated detection and monitoring and detection, and automated incident resolution. Right?
Okay, so, if I'm wrong, so now back I heard that like everything the automated and the monitoring you talk about is system center suite, right?
No. We have a component called Windows Azure, or now it's called Azure, of course, Azure Fabric, which does the systems, the service management aspect. We don't use service, we don't use System Center within Azure for orchestrating apps. That's more use on the private cloud. Yes. So the underlying hypervisor is Hyper-V. So that's the service healing piece. And then finally, if you start building more complex applications which you want to run across regions, you have a service called Traffic Manager that you can leverage. So the functionality of this Traffic Manager is, you have a global DNS record, and the Traffic Manager component can have rules configured into it, which says where a given request should get redirected. So you can redirect different requests to different regions depending on your rules, and you can use that to maintain high availability for region.
Is the geo-mapping is can be possible?
Sorry, can you?
If I'm having a site and having different hosting in different countries,
yes.
Is IP-based routing is possible?
Yes, that's a core functionality. Okay.
Is there any roadmap for feature like Route 50?
Yes, there is. So you're talking about customer has the ability to manage their DNS.
Yes. Is it possible if you are having one data center as our own, not in Azure, and one in Azure, is it possible to redirect to that site also?
That I'm not 100% sure of. So if you give me your contact, I'll get back.
If one of the region is down, let's say for a temporary period for any faulty reason.
Yeah.
The traffic management will automatically transfer it to a new region?
Yes, you can configure that.
Thank you.
So that's part of the value prop, right? So we are talking about cross-region highway.
Similar
region,
similar third-party managed DNS provider, till the time you get a third DNS service, the one which you have, sorry, you know, post your
So you can use it, you know, you can use it to say, like there was a question about how do you set up a rule where depending on where my client IP came from, I send it to the appropriate region. You can use that in that manner.
But can it be used in combination with your CDN service and the traffic manager? Because the CDN also serves
the traffic for years. I don't know. I don't have a depth of understanding. So, unfortunately, I'm just getting this part of my screen getting cut off. So, the purpose of this slide, I'll just talk through the key points, is to understand, you know, how a hyperscale cloud platform like Azure is different from kind of your enterprise data center, right? So, the left side represents kind of business, and the right side is the technical advantages. So, on the business, I'll just focus on a couple things. So the first thing I'll focus on is how the budget works. So in enterprise IT, it's a big, huge cost that you have to commit. It's a fixed cost, or you can talk about it as a CapEx model. In the cloud, it becomes more of a rate-based or an OpEx model. So typically, business cases that are unleashed is, you know, somebody who has to do periodic testing and who keeps a bunch of hardware sitting around for those test passes is one example. Or if you have an application where there's a bunch of traffic close to a deadline, right? So typical example that we looked at in the beginning in Microsoft was our own performance appraisal application. So if you're anything like me, you're filling it out on the last day. And so a bunch of traffic comes on the last day. So people have to provision enough capacity for that one spike. So these kind of patterns become very easy to handle in the cloud, where you can just increase your capacity or scale out your capacity when you need it. So that benefit you get with the rate-based model. And then the other really important point that I see resonating a lot with customers is the talent piece. Because managing infrastructure is hard, and every company is putting some really smart people on managing infrastructure. And if a hyperscale provider comes along who provides all the features that the customer needs, now all the talent can be freed up to innovating on your line of business applications, making it better. And now if we provide you cloud capabilities, there are opportunities available which you didn't have before, which is, think about, you build instrumentation into your app and you collect data on, so that's where there's a couple points around data, on what are your customers doing, how are the customers using the features, what are the things they're failing to do, so then you can just build this iterative data-driven model to make your applications better. So those are the things that you can focus your talent on. So those are the key business benefits that I see. Coming to the technical side, really the key step forward that a hyperscale platform gives you is software-based as opposed to hardware-based. So that's where the whole game changes. So now you can think about, if I look at the network availability piece, right? When I have a hardware-based, I have to really make huge investments to make sure I have the, I get the SLA. But when I have software-based and I have the ability to automatically recover from incidents, etc., the level of investment I have to make to get the same level of service goes down drastically. Other interesting things that I see is a lot of people in enterprise IT, again coming back to the same pattern, they look at mean time between failure. Because you bought this massive piece of equipment or massive cluster of servers or whatever it is, you can't afford for it to go down. So it's all optimized around mean time between failures. In the cloud, we are running commodity servers at scale. We are expecting them to fail, and our skill set is around bringing it back up as quickly as possible. So that's the mean time to recover. Right? So a couple of other interesting things. Deployment time becomes super interesting to people, where in enterprise IT, your deployment cycle tends to take weeks. In the cloud, for somebody who's really truly adopted the cloud, your deployment time is really, I've seen teams deploying multiple times. So this is not an exaggeration. So this is about the availability of an individual device. No. So this one is like an individual piece of the network. So in aggregate, we will provide you with, so for VMs, we provide 99.95. And for storage, we provide 99.95. Yes. Okay, so that was the infrastructure pieces, and I just want to speak a little bit about how much time we have. So we talked about trust, right? So there's the physical infrastructure pieces, there's the software, and then the key part of the infrastructure that you get is your peace of mind. We have the security, are your VM secure, is your data secure, is anybody accessing the data in the way you don't expect, etc. So all these, so security, privacy, and compliance are vast domains in themselves. I just wanted to focus on one sliver of the security piece, which customers ask me every day. Like, I go in and I say, look, I'm responsible for, like, India regions coming up, etc. Everybody asks me a question about, so they say, look, I'm used to running my data or my VMs in my own enterprise, or in a hoster where it's locked in a cage, I know that nobody can access it. Now, all of a sudden, you want to run it in the cloud. I don't know. Explain to me, how is this thing going to work? How am I going to be secure? So that's the piece which I want to spend some time and share. So I'm talking mainly about the logical security piece in this whole space. So like the whole security and infrastructure protection is a big space, as I mentioned. Just give you secondary to a slide, but I'll focus on logical say here. Alright, so here's our architecture for multi-tenancy. Right, so you're running your guest VMs. So it's probably good to start with terminology. So when you bring your own VHD, or when you spin up a VM from a VM gallery, or when you spin up a cloud service, what you're doing is you're running some guest VMs in our cloud. Right? So that's the guest VMs. Now where is the guest VM running? It has to be running on a host OS, right? Which has a hypervisor running. So those three pieces people understand. There's something called a fabric controller where you asked a question about system center. So this is the piece which orchestrates the deployment of these VMs. Okay, so think about, there's some kind of communication happening between this guy and this guy. And if one goes down, then it has the state, it brings another up, it checks for the health, etc. So that's the function of the fabric controller. So now, if you really start thinking about, if you get into the next piece.
What is hypervisor?
So hypervisor is your virtualization piece, right? Which allows you to run virtual machines on top of the whole process. So now, if I really now start thinking about this scenario of, I brought in my VM, and they could be God knows who else is running a VM on the same machine. Let's assume that they are a malicious hacker or a malicious actor, because anybody can sign in with a credit card, and they are bent upon compromising my VM. So how does Microsoft put it? That's the question. So let's talk about the different interfaces that we have to worry about. We have to isolate the guest VM from the host OS, right? So that the guest VM can't compromise the host OS. We have to isolate the guest VM from another guest VM, and we have to isolate the guest VM from the fabric. So the isolating the guest VM from the host OS is basically 30 years of OS security experience or more, decades that Microsoft has. And there's all kinds of different stuff that goes into it. I'll just leave it by saying that, you know, we have decades of experience in host OS security.
There was a blog post on the blog last week on the GrowHammer exploit. It talks about underlining hypervisor bits and it's compromised. Actually, they are protected against the GrowHammer
security. Yeah, see, we keep getting. So that's a normal procedure where vulnerabilities keep coming to light and we keep fixing. So that's the expertise that we've built up over. So you have, so that's the first piece. Let's talk about the, so let's elaborate a little bit on that. So in addition to kind of the OS security and the kind of layer after layer of protection that we build into our OS, we also do network packet filtering. So essentially what we do is we have packet filters built both into the hypervisor and the host OS, which restrict the kind of network traffic that can flow between a guest and the host. So examples of things that the guest is not allowed to do is the guest cannot receive traffic that is not directed to it. The guest cannot spoof traffic. The guest cannot broadcast traffic. So there's severe restrictions on what a guest OS can do within that environment. Okay, so the network packet filtering is another layer of protection. And then within the guest VMs, we have, you get to choose what endpoints you expose. Right? So you can choose to say, I won't take any traffic from any other guest VM in the network, etc. And there are certain basic standard practices that everybody adopts for maintenance of security platform. And then in terms of where it comes to protecting the guest, protecting the fabric from the guest. Right? So it comes back to your question earlier, sir, about VLANs. So the fabric controllers run in their own VLAN, and the guest VMs run in their own VLAN. And so the kind of communication that has to happen is the fabric has to ping for status. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question was about how do we scale? How many VLANs can we have? So you get a fabric controller per scale unit. So it doesn't have to worry about all our global capacity.
Aren't you using network virtualization, NVDR and SDNC?
Network virtualization.
So that's what we do in a fabric controller environment. We don't rely on VLANs right now, right?
we don't actually need to worry about the data.
So I'm honestly, I'm not familiar with those components. Like what I know is that here what we do is we create, we just create restricted environments for the fabrics to communicate among each other. And we create a control pipe for the fabrics to communicate with the host OSs. And so there's one-way communication between the VLANs so that the host OSs can't communicate back to the fabric. So that's a key layer of connection. And we do support V6. So we do support V6 traffic coming into the SPS. So all the communication within our network still happens only. So you can build a virtual network across your on-prem and your Azure, and you can assign your own IP addresses. No. So that's independent of it. You can build a virtual. We'll do a little bit of. So that's kind of the secure multi-tenancy. Yes, we do have. So that's a whole separate topic. So we do support our own as well as third party, and we have an agent injection framework, etc. To keep all those answers. Yeah.
Microsoft is free.
Yeah. So if you want to use a third party, it might be a support.
Microsoft.
We do basic. We give you basic.
As the Azure is, we are configuring all through the portal.
Yes.
Actually, it is having only one level of authentication there. Is it possible to make a second level of authentication that it is not feeling secure?
So yeah, you're talking about, so let's talk about authentication and authorization separately. So you have to reach any Azure, so keep in mind that Azure is a variety of services. Right? So we have 40, 50, 60 services that comprise the Azure platform. And you can build secure communication with any of our endpoints using certs. Right? And you can also use Azure Active Directory to build more complex. You can use multi-factor authentication. So you can do
in this portal.
Yeah, yeah. And keep in mind that all the functionality that we provide is accessible through REST API as well as the portal. So if you want to scale to multiple deployments across different regions, etc., you have the ability to build scripts through our REST API. So let's talk briefly about data segregation as well along the lines. So storage isolation, we have basically we can create we control access to storage through storage account keys, which control access at the account level. So you can create a storage account and put your blobs in the storage account, and those have keys associated with it, which control access to the account. If you want to give more fine-grained access to blobs within the storage account, you can use something called a shared access signature key or SAS key. Where essentially what you're doing is you're giving access to a particular blob or a particular container, set of blobs or set of artifacts, and associating some amount of policy along with it, like for how long is this access valid and so on. So those are the mechanisms.
So is it just keys for data indexing at brand or part part?
You have to use a different tool if you want. So this is more for authentication for access.
Your
by default encrypt data address. So SQL isolation, we just use a standard SQL account methodology to isolate SQL databases. Quick brief on virtual networks. So you can create a virtual network across your pod and cloud using virtual networks. You don't necessarily, so express route is more for provisioning dedicated bandwidth.
But can you create a VNet across to
each? So we don't yet have the concept of an availability zone.
If you do
regions,
yeah.
can you create a VNet across the nodes? Is the question. We can, recently, right? So we've recently added the gateway. So here again, I think this one just alludes to you can control what endpoints and what level access you get. You can create kind of subnets within your virtual network. You can give different level of access to different subnets. Like for example, you can create one subnet that's publicly accessible. Your backend resources are on a different subnet, so you can do as much of fine grained kind of logical isolation. So that's our solution for logical isolation. So that's really the key pieces that I plan to cover. So on privacy, it's more about customers can choose the data location and replication options. We talked about that. So with the India data centers coming in, you've got data sovereignty, data residency. So you can control your data to stay within the boundaries of the country. We have various policies where we guarantee kind of in what modes the data will be accessed, will access the data, and so forth. And then we have various different compliance certifications. In fact, among all the public cloud, we share count of compliance certifications we have. And we recently got some government certifications for the first initial information. So that pretty much brings me to the end of it. So pretty much a summary of the benefits. So you get the scale, you get library, you get protection, then you adopt a hyperscale cloud platform. We are making a number of investments across the world, the last point, which will accrue to you. And so you automatically get it. So if we haven't launched it yet, we'll be launching it shortly. So we'll have three locations. Two will be Maharashtra State.
I would like to ask about scaling Azure platform. One of the core issues that I have with the DigitalOcean is that when I have to switch to let's say a higher based more RAM, more hard disk requirement, then I have to firstly switch off the virtual machine and have to wait for at least 30 to 40 minutes for it to provide me the solution for a better disk space, more disk space. How much time does it take to do scale in Azure?
So it depends on your particular, how your particular app migrates, right? So like spinning up a new VM can happen in a matter of seconds.
Okay.
Now, depending on what workload you have and how it migrates from one VM to another, we'd have to look at
it. It will take us 5-10 minutes.
So question will, it will not be more than 2 minutes. So whatever time it takes to turn down the VM and then change the size. So let's say you are running 4GB RAM, something else, then you want to make it 8GB, turn off the VM, change that in the settings, turn it back. It could be 1 minute, 2 minute, it depends how fast you are. But it's a manual thing. It's a manual thing. Or you can try to automation.
Yeah, but in that, there
is some limitation. It doesn't happen. Just think about it. Think about it. At the end of the day, it's running a VM. If you want to change core configuration, like a RAM performance, have to bring it down for a fraction of seconds. Therefore, I said it could be a minute or two or 30 seconds depending on how fast you turn it off, change it, bring it back. Okay, it can be. So one caveat, if you're running a old VM, let's say you're running an Azure VM in A2 size for 2 years, and now suddenly you want to make it like, I don't know, A13 or A8, no, it is more A15, you want to have A. So what happens at the time when it was being put on, it was an older server. So it might ask you to use a VHD and create a new VM because the restriction is which cluster it was being put 2 years ago. Now we're doing a lot of consolidation and upgradation in the backend, so you want to keep it going forward.
Right now, even we cannot move from all sizes, right? If you have, let's say, A0, right now we cannot move to a T or a
So that's the point. To tell me, do you really, on premises, how exactly it works? it's really, when you talk about scale, it's not that today I'm running, you know, on 2 GB and tomorrow I need 24. Then you have no idea about capacity planning. So you also, whenever you move, it will be some reasonable 20%, 50%, right? It won't be 100%. So, you know, that's where we are. And then we are also hosting it on servers, right? So if you're going to have a high RAM, based VM, it will be put on another cluster, reserve is a high CPU. Maybe if you want to add more.
The next release of Hyper-V is coming up with what add of RAM. Can we expect the same in it?
Yes, not. But I don't know. I'm not the best person to talk
about it.
If you have a right, so
InfiniBand is there in
certain skills. Yeah.
So to answer your question, so we continuously pull in. So like both the our objective is to merge or converge private cloud and public. So any new features that come will eventually come in. But it's a question of how quickly
we will. Lacking is the BLDM support.
So piece by piece we'll address feedback and
what happens to the current services which are running say in Southeast Asia or East Asia and you want to pull them back to the India data center? So is there going to be a seamless migration path available?
So it depends on the complexity of the application. So if you built a really complex network, right, and you're expecting to migrate it with zero availability impact, that's a big call order.
Not about zero availability, but for example, the costing typically should not change. But say I'm willing to give it a bit of downtime and then have it migrated. So will that path be available?
We will have.
Yeah.
And typical experience that
same
I see.
Same, right, if you want to migrate from Northeast Asia to East Asia, whatever step you follow, you know,
same thing. And what we've seen, I'll add this now. So, what we've seen in other, like I've been involved in other launches like Japan, Australia, etc. The typical path that I see customers going is, for example, in Japan, customer is running in East Asia, and now Japan came up. The ones that I've seen who are most successful in doing it in the most compressed amount of time took a conservative approach where they spun up new resources in Japan first, built confidence, and slowly. And then if you look at the graph, it slowly falls off in East Asia and quickly picks up. So that would be the safest way. When you go from hardware to software, you get the ability to scale that. So you can keep adding. So essentially, what you're building is a distributed service. Your question is, will you be able to achieve the same scale in Azure? Yes. So short answer is yes.
Network
crashing. Yes. Still look doubtful.
India availability July.
So we haven't announced the date yet. We'll be available. We'll be opening up our regions by the end of this calendar.
Pretty much.
By 31st December.
All the three or just the
all the three.
Any plan for data centers?
So eventually, you know, if you look at our history across the globe, so as demand, as we find demand, so it's always pragmatic to start with a small footprint, build the presence, build the market. So then as we see, so two in Maharashtra and one in Tamil Nadu is what I'm allowed to disclose. Yes. So we'll have pairs. So out of the three, two will be full pairs, and one will be a one bit.
No east west.
Eventually, maybe.
All the three are open for the consumer or anything reserved for the government usage.
All the three will be open.
It's not dedicated to government.
So there is a dedicated government stamp or GOI, I guess. So we have a dedicated government cloud in AWS. These are tough questions. So I think we are working with the policy makers in the government. So we would like, we have various governments across the world who are adopting public cloud.
Compliance.
So they are yet to define their policy. So once they define their framework, it will become clear what workloads can come. Yeah, see, and if you look at the government itself, it's just like any other enterprise. It's got high critical workloads, it's got low criticality workloads. So it makes sense.
Regularity and compliance is the word it separates.
Correct. For high criticality workloads, of course we would want, like, it's in our best interest as citizens that we have a rock solid framework, right? And for the low criticality, you can start moving to the public. For sure. And then we'll see where it lands for the So you'll get a limit with Express Route, you'll get a limit of bandwidth. I haven't heard of that. That's an interesting one. As far as I am aware, you can't control your network.
That's a member of you. You know how much file is there. Typically, you have to upload, let's say, 5 GB data or 5 TB data. You know how much. So that's a calculation you should do. From Azure, and as soon as you enter the Azure data center, don't worry about bandwidth and how much we can take absolutely petabytes of data in. But mostly the choking happens from your premises. Who ISP hops, and depending on how much bandwidth you have, right? If that's the homework you will do, and depending on that you choose a set of data transfer, see how much bandwidth it has taken, and that's the capacity bandwidth.
So export import
server. If you're working with Microsoft, there is a support again. All you need now is to put everything in a disk and ship it with FedEx or something to that data center, then they will put it in and then you can bring your VMs on. That's a very tried and tested. Not till now.
What about the licensing system?
There are many things, So not supported till now. Exchange and link from market center.
compute there are there in OPC 65.
That's why.
So he partially answered, but yeah. But some of you might want for that matter, shape until also.
It works. It works perfectly.
Absolutely.
It works perfectly.
So he answered that, right? So that's
multi-tech
is there, but that is more for virtual appliances. it will definitely progress better. If you have anything specific for India data center, ask him. A couple of you have had some questions. I would like to
take
location. You will get to know. Why does it matter?
Yeah.
You are most fortunate. Let me tell you that. Yeah.
Go to Chapel Hill.
Huh?
Go to Chapel Hill.
No idea. Anything more specific to us, since he is the guy who has sort of put with the blueprint together before? More from India data center, general, I'm going to be there.
So, I mean, just a very generic question. Is it a private Microsoft data center, or is it co-built with an ISP or one of the telecom providers? That is one of the stories that we are hearing.
So, I mean, when we enter a new geo, we won't be making huge investments as we go in.
Partnering with
the
existing
hosting provider.
Yeah, we typically leverage partners when we enter. Yes. So the timelines aren't decided yet, but
all the services
will
be deployed on certain sites, will start
first, and then will be. So all. I would say the services which are used in 95% of your use cases.
Awesome. So, who's going to ask a good question? Give away. Yeah. Coming to your question, yes, we are using NVGRE. So, just imagine you put up multiple virtual networks and you use 10-dot range like 20 times. How are you going to do that? So, as soon as you have started. Yeah, so just remind Suresh that you have a very good
Great. I hope they thank you.
We can share?
Sure.
Whatever is shareable, yes.
Yeah, the whole thing is shared.
This is shareable.
Is there any common link for all the Moodle sets?
No, so it's not been because there are a few things that we might want to share but not, give it out. But it will, all the shareable slides will be there on the Azure Conference website.
Same website.
Go next week, mostly. Give us like a week's time. You should.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah.
Please give feedback.
Yes, please give feedback. Thank you so much. See you tomorrow.
Yes.
And you've been a great audience. So.